Hi everyone, welcome back to The Restaurant Innovator, a podcast from the editors of FSR Magazine that features conversations with trailblazing chefs, restaurateurs, tech innovators, and other folks in the food service world who are leading the charge in creating elevated experiences for modern guests and employees alike. I'm your host and FSR editor, Callie Evergreen, joined by my colleague and co-host, Sam Danley, associate editor. I'm excited to introduce you to our special guest on today's episode, Eddie Escriba, operations partner at Oaxaca Club and director of culinary operations for Restaurant Hospitality Investment Group. Chef Eddie, thank you so much for joining us. Can you start off by introducing yourself and briefly walking us through your background?
Sure. Thank you for having me. My name is Eddie Escriba, and like you mentioned, you know, I am here the head of the food operations for our brands here at HRG. And a little bit on my background, I've been in the industry for, you know, about 30 years. Started my career at Florida Culinary in West Palm Beach, then worked in the island of Palm Beach, did a few stages in some, what was, you know, back then the standard, the starred restaurants from your local newspapers. So we're very proud to, you know, be always named in, you know, the West Palm Beach food pages. It was a great experience, you know. A lot of transplants from New York and a lot of what they call snowbirds coming to Palm Beach, giving people an elevated, you know, service and avant-garde food. You know, they were coming from New York, so they knew exactly what they were getting and what they were eating. So, yes, you know, very lucky to find myself as a young chef in that environment. From there, I moved around, you know, the West Palm Beach area and made it to Jacksonville, where, you know, I successfully, I can say, opened a number of restaurants, including a brand that was big in the early 2000s here in Jacksonville. The brand was called Burrito Gallery. From there, again, you know, open restaurants for either associates, and really that became my job, you know, going and doing the big openings, setting up menus, setting up a meeting with the architects, laying out kitchens. So, you know, until then, that has been, you know, my work until now at Oaxaca Club. Then we put a team together to bring something very, very unique, a Oaxacan restaurant with, I want to say, authentic food and spirits to cater to the Jacksonville Beach area here in Florida.
So, you were approached by Restaurant Hospitality Investment Group initially to develop a Mediterranean concept. How did you guys like pivot from that idea to then doing a Mexican food concept instead?
Yes. You know, we are still opening our Mediterranean concept, Alder and Oak. The opportunity came about to where there was a developer, and they had a spot, pretty large spot here at the beach, and always under the I always get the acronym, you know, mixed up, but under the brand, Mark Janicek, who is owner partner, wanted a Mexican concept. And I think that really, the space here in Jack's Beach lended to that concept, more so than our Mediterranean concept. We already had picked out the location for Alder and Oak in Riverside, an area here in Jacksonville. And you know, plans and everything were already on the way. That place will be, you know, construction will start within the next, you know, month, I'd say. This was already a building that was up and going. So we switched gears, and basically I like to say to him, you know, the building fell on our lap. This project fell on our lap, you know, because it was not under the radar. And he says, do you want to open a Mexican restaurant? And I'm like, well, let's go for it. And that's how our travels to Oaxaca started.
Yeah. Tell us about the travels to Oaxaca. You went down there, spent some time kind of learning and understanding the food of that region.
Yes.
What are some of the big takeaways from that experience? And how did that kind of end up shaping the end result of the restaurant?
I think that, you know, I had been traveling to Mexico City, and Mexico City is an enormous, you know, urban area, city, great food scene. You know, we were very lucky to end up at Pujol being the number 9 restaurant in the world when we visited. Enrique Olvera, you know, put Mexican food on the world stage. You know, I have to say that, you know, we knew Mexican food as tacos, burritos, you know, 10 years ago. And if you guys know of Enrique Olvera's, you know, restaurant in Mexico, Pujol, where you have people from all over the world coming and visiting the restaurant to see what he was doing, then we were lucky enough. That, you know, got my interest. Knowing that, you know, Mexican food is not just tacos and really, you know, black beans and rice. There's a lot more. There's such a diverse climate throughout Mexico, and it lends for an array of products that people, you know, clearly use. And when we were in Oaxaca, we traveled through the markets. And I really, anyone that is interested in Mexican food, you know, you should get on a plane and visit Oaxaca. From, you know, the moles and the simplicity of going to a market, eating a fresh made tortilla with beans and a salsa matcha and queso fresco. You know, it is a transforming experience because the ingredients are so, so simple, but yet, you know, it is heritage corns that they've been using. You know, it is beans and cheeses that are only made in the area. And you cannot compete with nature. You cannot compete with, you know, the simplicity and, again, the just, you know, great food. So this is how our, you know, journey started, you know, through the markets. Clearly, we visited some other nicer restaurants, you know, and where the chef are able to express and translate what they see in the marketplace, what they see in the local food stands, and put it in a restaurant setting. So, again, great, you know, for foodies, is a great destination. And, you know, it's equally as Mexico City is. You can find any type of cuisine in Mexico City, and you know, it's done right. People are very proud of their craft when it comes to service and hospitality. There's a certain pride that goes with, you know, the service, and you could, it's a lot of, you know, the young generation, you know, these chefs, you see them doing pop-ups all over the place. It excites me, you know, truly, to see that, you know, the craft's still alive. And it's not a job. It is not something that people see as, you know, clearly they're doing it for the love of the food, you know, and the craft.
Hmm. So. Going back to the beginnings of your culinary journey, you know, I saw that you began, you know, your early years growing up in Guatemala City. I'm curious, you know, how those Saturday morning market days influenced and ignited kind of your love and passion for, you know, local fresh ingredients and just influenced you going into the culinary industry.
Well, really, you know, I went to the market with my mother on Saturdays. She would go and pick out groceries for pretty much the week, you know, working family. My mom and dad both worked. So she had to go and buy, you know, produce and meats and things, just like as we do here once a week. The markets are really centrally localized in the neighborhoods. But I would go with her because I would get to eat everything and anything that I wanted, you know, the fresh juices and fruits and everything. She, you know, I would carry baskets and she would treat me with, you know, all those goodies from the market. That opened my palate to, you know, knowing where products were in season, even how to, you know, negotiate pricing, you know, with people at the market, you know, because it is culturally part of, you know, you're not going to pay what they tell you, you know, you have to haggle down and really negotiate, you know, the pricing that you want. But, you know, it was something that there was always great fresh ingredients at home. Now, I did not start my career in food. You know, I studied education in Cleveland. Then I worked for a retailer as a buyer, and I was a buyer in hardlines. Hardlines are, you know, your housewares, your decorative home, and, you know, the company would have these demonstrations. So that called my attention. So I was in the kitchen, you know, demonstrating, you name it, you know. The store manager would leave for lunch, go into the mall, come back, and I have the store smelling like hot dogs, you know, but, you know, that curiosity, you know, and always trying to play with food. Unfortunately, the store took a turn and they went in, you know, some financial troubles, and it opened, you know, the possibilities for me to change of careers, right? And that's how I ended up in the food industry. I took some time off. Did some research, and the school called my attention. Went to visit the school. It was a brand new school, beautiful labs or kitchens, and never looked back ever since. You know, I was really blessed to find something, you know, in my life that not only I can use my ability to cook, but also a passion and not see it as really work. And that's very important.
And, you know, after leaving school, you've had the opportunity to work with various mentors at various types of restaurants, various parts of the country. What are some of the biggest lessons or insights that you've gained from those experiences that have shaped your approach to cooking or just like restaurant management in general?
Yes. So I worked, and I think that one of my biggest mentors, his name is Rick Klein, and he now owns a small diner in West Palm Beach. It's called City Diner. But Rick Klein, same as, you know, I feel that his determination, you know, his determination to perfection, you know, he was someone that, you know, really did things over and over and over until got things perfected. At the time, you know, people in Palm Beach used to say that there were nicer restaurants, but Joe's restaurant at the time, you know, in the late 90s, had the best food. Rick worked and did some stages at La Côte Basque in New York. It's a restaurant that is no longer there, but Chef Rashu was one of those wave of immigrant chefs that came in the late 50s, you know. Lutez, La Côte Basque, all these French restaurants that came in, you know, the innovation of French Nouvelle Cuisine that came to the United States it was unknown, you know, reductions for sauces, very delicate dishes, you know, that really highlighted the ingredients and not masking heavy sauces or things, you know, as French cooking can be somewhat heavy, you know, part of the Nouvelle movement is those lighter sauces, using reductions instead of using starches to thicken, you know, a sauce. So I think that, you know, that was one of my highlights. Then I went to work for a company called Big Time Restaurant Group in West Palm Beach also. Elizabeth Suma, you know, she's also, I have to say, another incredible chef and determined. You know, when you see female chefs, you know, come above, you know, a world of male chefs in this industry, you know, those ladies have guts, you know, you see them and also their perseverance and determination when it comes to making it in this industry. Because as I mentioned before, you know, it may take a toll on personal life, you know, your physical life as well. But yes, I have to say that, you know, she's also another person that I attribute, you know, my knowledge, the passion of cooking and management styles. All these chefs really had staff that worked for them for 10, 15 years because they were part of a family. And I try to, in my ventures, I treat people as family, you know, and, you know, their concern becomes your concerns, you know, their problems. And I think there's a lot of restaurants in this industry. There's a lot of owners that really care for their staff, you know, and, you know, we're glad to say that, you know, we are a group that definitely pay a lot of attention to our staff and their needs.
How have you created kind of the right environment to retain employees? That's one of the biggest challenges we're seeing in the restaurant industry, always has been, and likely, you know, it seems like always will be. But, you know, how have you kind of figured out how to keep employees and staff happy?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when it comes to our group, you know, our tagline is to lead with kindness. You know, I think that one, training is essential. You know, a well-trained staff, I think that, you know, they have a better chance out there on the sales floor, as I call it, to feel more confident. You know, confidence builds you, and, you know, you add the kindness of the managers and your fellow workers, and you have a recipe for, you know, retaining your employees. I think I mentioned before, you know, if they know where they stand coming to work, you know, if they know, you know, keep them informed. Communication is huge, right? You know, we're in this era of a lot of apps, and there's really no reason why someone can't download an app, you know, your Messenger, all these things, to be able to communicate for your staff. You know, just a couple of words, you know, we're going to be very busy tonight, you know, be ready, you know, so they know exactly what they're coming into, and know that, you know, you're keeping them in mind. I think that's appreciated. But, you know, giving them the right tools and you know, the pay, you know, compatible wages, you know, because that's we see an increase right now in wages all over the place. And, you know, that hits our bottom line. As business owners, you know, we're in the business of making money, not losing money, no matter what business you're in, right? As it is, you know, fun, and it is, you know, something that we're very satisfied with. We have responsibilities, you know, to our investors. We have responsibilities to ourselves. and to our employees. It wouldn't be fun if we open a restaurant and 6 months later, we have to let go, you know, half of your staff, or we have to close the doors because we can't make. So as we are, you know, kind to our employees and, you know, we see this utopian world, we need to put very close attention to our numbers. And, you know, you can have three great trained staff members versus, you know, six or seven, you know, members that are not well trained. And, you know, that's where the financials, you know, make a difference. Train your staff well, and, you know, the benefits are there.
And then, you know, kind of diving into the food side of things, I'm curious, you know, your process of developing and creating the menu, you know, what kind of creative dishes are setting you apart? What are some of your favorite dishes that you've created on the menu?
Yeah. You know, being that we're a Oaxacan restaurant, the first thing to go on the menu and the first thing to translate was a Oaxacan mole. So you see in Oaxaca has seven moles, and the mole negro is their quintessential, you know, staple of Oaxaca. Between the recipes change from family to family, but standard is, you know, about 31 to 32 ingredients, from seeds to stale bread to tortillas to the dried peppers. So our challenge was, where are we going to find these dried peppers that are coming from Oaxaca? We did our research. We found a company that carries about 14 different dried peppers. You know, you go to your local market and you may find three, right? But so we did our research. We got a hold of a company, and lucky enough, we're able to find a lot of the same peppers that we saw in the stores in Oaxaca. We walked into a store, and as a spice market, you know, this place was incredible. You know, things that you don't see in the States because they are so unique to the climate and the use. But again, we were able to find that, and started with our mole. Our mole chicken, you know, quickly became one of the staples. Another dish is the enmoladas. So enmoladas are a Oaxacan version of enchiladas. The enmoladas are a mole sauce, a quesadilla, you know, per se, covered with a mole, stuffed with cheese, and we put barbacoa in ours here at the restaurant. So, you know, some of those dishes that set us apart from the typical enchilada suizas at your local Tex-Mex restaurant, right? When it comes to our guacamole, really, you know, it's four ingredients: avocado, lime juice, salt, pepper, and we put some cilantro in there. But that's it. We are very lucky, again, to the same company that provided the peppers, provide avocados for us from Mexico. And as seasons change, they've been very, very bringing those products to us. They've been consistent in bringing all these products that are hard to find here. I'm saying that avocados are hard to find, but, you know, consistently a good avocado is hard to find. And they have their own farms in Oaxaca, so they bring these products to us.
You guys also have a Oaxaca Club Mezcal, like a proprietary spirit offered at the restaurant. Walk us through that program. There's a collaborative element with local producers in Oaxaca with that as well, right?
Yes. So as we were in Oaxaca, we were invited to Mal de Amor. Is in Oaxaca, the distilleries are called palenques. So we were invited to the Palenque Mal de Amor, and they are the producers of Mezcal Ilegal. It's a huge brand You know, you pretty much go to any bar and you will find two mezcals, Vida and Ilegal. And when we were there, we were walked through the whole process of making mezcal, how they cut the piñas, the ground ovens, the woods they use, the whole process, you know, even the tahona with the horse smashing the cooked piñas. It was something very unique and fun to see because they use these methods of fermentation outdoors. So, you know, you get the wild yeast from the air, you know, that help to ferment these products. There's, you know, an incredible process in how mezcal is made. While we were there, we inquire about if they could make a brand, and they're like, well, you know, we are too busy with the Mezcal Ilegal brand. We came back to the States with that seed planted. How do we get our mezcal? We did some research here in town, and we found someone that had a connection with a mezcalero in Oaxaca. And we got our really, you know, our wheels and our mind, you know, started to turn and work. And within 1 year, we had our own brand here in Jacksonville, Florida. It is a sixth-generation mezcalero. You know, the family there has been, you know, making mezcal for a long time. And, you know, it's still the same process. You know, very ancient, because we have, you have traditional and you have the ancient ways of making mezcal in the copper pots or clay pots. They use copper pots, you know, in our distillation process. It is distilled four times. It is a mezcal joven, great to sip or great to mix into our, you know, signature cocktails here at the restaurant. But we also have a distribution company, Bottles and Barrels, and we are distributing this mezcal to other restaurants and a few liquor stores around town. You know, we wanted to expand the brand, and also, you know, we do tastings in these places because, you know, Oaxaca and mezcal, you know, go together. And again, really want to get the word out on this spirit that people are still not quite, you know, it's smoky, it's, you know, rare. You know, either you like it or you don't. But I do believe that the, you know, process is if you are a tequila drinker, you know, you will end up, you know, tasting mezcal and getting into the different types of agaves. That's how the mezcal started.
And so, you know, talking about kind of educating the public on mezcal, you know, you have over 50 selections, and a lot of that, I'm assuming, you know, kind of goes back to training your staff members to be able to talk to, you know, the guests about it, right?
Yeah, definitely. We have something that is called Mezcal Mondays. In Mezcal Mondays, we bring in either a sales rep or one of our bartenders or a bar manager will select three mezcals, you know, a flight, any particular brand, and we will discuss with our staff members. But we also is there for any customer that wants to come and learn about mezcals. Right? So it's interesting. I don't know if you guys know the process, but, you know, out of 350 types of agave, only 30 of them are used for the production of mezcal, right? The most commonly used is the Espadín agave, and that's the widely cultivated, you see the fields, you know, in Oaxaca. Then you have the wild agaves. So Espadín agave takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years for the plant to mature. And then it gets, you know, they cut it, and they cook it, and you get the liquid to make your mezcal. Wild agaves up in the Sierras can take anywhere from 15 to 20 years to mature for the plants to get full flavor. And not only that, but they're humongous. You know, these plants, some piñas can be up to 1,200 pounds, you know. So it's truly, you know, tequila is aged in barrels. People that drink mezcal, they say that mezcal is aged in nature, you know. They have, some of the farms have gone up in the Sierras and collected the small plants, the pups from the agave, and they bring them down to a more controlled environment, you know, so they don't, it's really, you know, a treacherous terrain to arid, you know, lots of rocks, and it's almost desert-like to go up in the Sierras and to find these, you know, big plants. So what they've done is, you know, when they're small enough, they bring them to the lower lands. Some types of, you know, that you can control more the environment, and not truly to speed the process, but to make it more accessible. And as I said, we have a big selection of mezcals, and you know, we're proud of it, because I think that here in Jacksonville, you know, that's another part that we're unique. You know, we invested a lot of money into it, and we are the only mezcal, true mezcal bar here in Jacksonville, with, you know, over 30 different selections.
Do you see that, like, consumer or customer culinary education piece, like, extending to the food itself? There's, you know, this focus on traditional techniques, you know, traditional ingredients, like you've been talking about. Is there kind of a connection with the guest dining experience and the food, like there is with the mezcal as well?
Yes, I think that, you know, customers appreciate some of the authenticity, and we thank food television for that. You know, people see something on TV, and the next thing they're Googling where you can get that, right? And we see that firsthand when we put something on our specials. They go online, and, you know, people start Googling, you know, where can you get that? And, but yes, TV shows have done a lot for our industry and a lot for, you know, that segment of more authentic, you know, restaurants. You know, Mexico is a vast country, as it is the United States. You know, we have something that's very unique in the South, as, you know, the food out West, you know, is different. It, you know, it's no different in Mexico or any other country. So I think that when people see something, you know, you have these great shows, you just finish a meal, you're eating you're eating something, watching a show, and you're still hungry. So this happened to me a number of times. Yeah, I think that, you know, when it comes to, let's say, the moles that we make, when it comes to the ceviches and aguachiles, you know, aguachile was a word that was not really known, let's say, you know, a few years ago. Nobody really knew what an aguachile is, right? Aguachile is, you know, your version of a ceviche in Mexico. So as soon as you see these shows pop up, you know, Taco Chronicles, great, great show, you know. People flock to these locations where they can find a more authentic experience. You know, the taquerias here in town are great. You know, there's different people from different cities in states in Mexico that bring their localized flavors to them. Because tacos from, let's say, Michoacán, you know, which are known for carnitas, you know, would not be the same as a taco from, let's say, Mexico City. These families come and they bring their traditions and ingredients of cooking and expressing themselves. And I think that as consumers, we're in a very good spot right now to be able to eat, you know, all these delicious food that's coming to us from, you know, our this, you know, immigrant wave.
Kind of looking to the future, are there any, you know, new projects or, you know, culinary adventures on the horizon for you that you'd be able to share with us today?
There's a couple of concepts that we have in the works. One of them being a Mediterranean concept. We just came back from Istanbul and, you know, we did a tour of local spots as well as, you know, some Michelin star restaurants in Istanbul. And, you know, just to see how chefs are expressing themselves using, you know, local ingredients, local food, something that you would find in the streets, you know, for, you know, a couple of dollars, you know, how they elevate this experience in an environment like a Michelin star restaurant. And, you know, we were blown away in how the talent has been able to manipulate and you know, come up with some great dishes in the restaurants that we, you know, that we visited. There's also an Italian concept that we're, that, you know, we have in the works. You know, a big pizza, brick pizza oven, wood fire oven, you know, is at the center of the kitchen. We don't want to do, you know, as we are, we'll have some pizzas. We want to cook in that oven. You know, we want those flavors of a, like a Florence style, you know, steak Florentine being cooked in this oven. You know, it's a firewood that gives a lot of flavor, smoke and the temperatures and all that. They played a great deal in an ancient cooking method. So, those are in the works, and, you know, hopefully in the next, you know, year and a half, you know, we'll have, you know, our two concepts running.
And kind of starting to wrap things up here, you know, looking back, not just on like the first year for Oaxaca Club, but just your career overall, what advice would you give to aspiring chefs or restaurateurs who are looking to make a mark on this industry?
I think that, you know, as we are every single restaurateur right now and aspiring chef is, I think that we get consumed with, you know, the process, you know, making the numbers work, all that, right? I think that be true to your idea, you know, think that if you have an idea, clearly it's something that is coming from your heart. And I think financials will start to develop. Think that being true to the idea, being true to, you know, what you want to do. You know, this is the determinations that some chefs, you know, and business versus creativity, you know, artistry versus business, you know, it's really always conflict. But I think that, you know, if you stay true to your roots and true to your ideas, people can sense that, you know, that is coming from the heart, and the financials will fall, you know, into play after that. You know, there are a lot of chefs out there that have been very talented and they have, you know, these great careers. But they just stuck to their guns, you know, and they're doing the food that they want, using the ingredients they want, not compromising on, you know, conceptually and what their craft is. And definitely, you know, they've been very successful. So that's one thing. And the other advice is that, you know, yes, we are in the food industry, but we're in the people industry, you know. There's so many people that come through our doors and they come through, you know, not only from employees, but also guests, you know. And I think that, you know, the hospitality is essential. You know, you want to treat, I'm a, you know, I'm a big I love parties at my house. You know, I always have people coming over for dinner, you know, and I want to make someone, it just, there's the Latin in me, right? You know, and I like to bring people and make them feel good, feed them, you know, I'm giving something of my own, you know, when I'm putting dishes together, you know, it's very primitive to sit around a table and talk about your day, talk about, you know, your family, you know, and get to know each other. It's something that I think that we're losing now, you know, in the world of the cyber world. And as we are here speaking, you know, through a camera, but when you have a chance, you know, I mean, it's great to sit down with, you know, family and friends and break bread with them, you know, and I think that that's something that, you know, when your guests and even your employees, you know, take the time to get to know your people, take the time to, you know, give of yourself to them as well. And I think that was probably the two biggest, you know, advice or pointers that I can give to people. You know, in our travels, we noticed that hospitality was number one. It could be a street vendor. It could be the people in the bazaars when we were in Istanbul. You know, hey, come here, you know, giving you a piece of baklava, you know, and giving you a piece of, you know, a piece of candy. Always, you know, with a smile. It's what I said before, you know, it's not a job. Once it becomes a task, once it becomes work, then I think you need to revisit what you're doing and, you know, come back to what really attracted you to, you know, your career and the things that you're doing.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Chef Eddie. If there are any listeners out there who want to learn more or contact you, can you give them the best way to do so?
Absolutely. My email, and I don't know if you guys, there's something to share it, but the restaurant is Oaxaca Club in Jack's Beach. And my email is eddy.escriba@theoaxacaclub.com. So you can reach me and, you know, drink some mezcal.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. And thank you to all of our listeners out there. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you so much.